The president's final 2 years in office could be as contentious as his first six. Republicans will control all of Congress, and a presidential campaign looms. Republicans are criticized for reflexively opposing the president. The president has been criticized for keeping his distance from Congress. Still, he is thinking of what he can do with his remaining time.
Now, I have the ability to focus on some long-term projects, including making sure that everybody is benefiting from this growth and not just some. And on the international front, even as we're managing ISIL and trying to roll them back and ultimately defeat them, even as we've been executing the drawdown in Afghanistan in a responsible way, the moves like the Cuba diplomatic initiative are ones that I want to make sure I continue to pursue, partly because, frankly, it's easier for a president to do at the end of his term than a new president coming in.
You were able to start Cuba without Congress, able to start on immigration without Congress. Yeah. Each of those issues cannot be fully resolved without Congress. Yeah. Is there anything that you personally intend to do differently in your approach to Congress in hopes of getting better results in your final 2 years than you have on some occasions in the past?
I can always do better in every aspect of my job, and congressional relations isn't exempt from that. I think the circumstances will have changed, though. I'm obviously frustrated with the results of the midterm election. I think we had a great record for members of Congress to run on, and I don't think we, myself, and the Democratic Party made as good of a case as we should have. And, you know, as a consequence, we had really low voter turnout, and the results were bad. On the other hand, now you've got Republicans in a position where it's not enough for them simply to grind the wheels of Congress to a halt and then blame me. They are going to be in a position in which they have to show that they can responsibly govern, given that they have significant majorities in both chambers. And, you know, what I've said repeatedly is that I want to work with them. I want to get things done. I don't have another election to run. There are going to be areas where we agree, and I'm going to be as aggressive as I can be in getting legislation passed that I think help move the economy forward and help middle-class families. There are going to be some areas where we disagree. And, you know, I haven't used the veto pen very often since I've been in office, partly because legislation that I objected to was typically blocked in the Senate even after the House took over, Republicans took over the House. Now I suspect there are going to be some times where I've got to pull that pen out, and I'm going to defend gains that we've made in health care. I'm going to defend gains that we've made on environment and clean air and clean water. But what I'm hopeful about, and we saw this so far at least in the lame duck, is a recognition by both Speaker Boehner and Mitch McConnell that people are looking to them to get things done, and that the fact that we disagree on one thing shouldn't prohibit us from getting progress on the areas where there's some overlap.
Well, let me figure out if there's overlap on immigration. In an interview in August, you described the Republican Party as being captive to nativist elements of the party.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that? And can you work with people who you think of in that way?
Well, on immigration, I probably can't. Steve King and I fundamentally disagree on immigration.
Yeah, I
if your view is that immigrants are either fundamentally bad to the country, or that we actually have the option of deporting 11 million immigrants, regardless of the disruptions, regardless of the cost, and that is who we are as Americans, I reject that. On the other hand, I think that there are a lot of Republicans who recognize that not only do we need to fix a broken immigration system, strengthen our borders, and streamline the legal immigration system, but that we have to show realism, practicality, and insist on accountability from those who are here illegally, and that the best way to do that is to provide them a path to get legal, paying a fine, submitting to background checks, and so forth. I think the Republican Party contains a lot of legislators who recognize that, and we know that because those folks voted for a comprehensive bill in the Senate that in many ways was more generous than I was able to offer through executive action. So the question then becomes, by me having taken these actions, does that spur those voices in the Republican Party who I think genuinely believe immigration is good for our country? Does it spur them to work once again with Democrats in my administration to get a reasonable piece of legislation done? Or does it simply solidify what I do think is a nativist trend in parts of the Republican Party? And if it's the latter, then probably we're not going to get much more progress done, and it'll be a major debate in the next presidential election.
I think that if a Republican lawmaker was sitting here, he might say, wait a minute, I'm not captive to nativist elements. I have actual concerns, and you're not addressing them.
Well, the problem is, what are those concerns, and how is it that I'm not addressing them? If the concern is border security, we've got more resources, more border police, more money being spent at our borders than any time in the last 30, 40 years. If the concern is the flow of illegal workers into the country, that flow is about half of what it was and is lower than any time since the 1970s. So, you know, you have to describe specifically what are the concerns that you've got.
That is some of our talk with President Obama, recorded just before the holidays at the White House. It's the final word you are likely to hear from the president in 2014. It was an interview on video, which you can see at NPR.org. And we will play more of our conversation here on Morning Edition tomorrow when we pose this question.
Is the United States more racially divided than it was when you took office 6 years ago, Mr. President?
No, I actually think that it's probably in its day-to-day interactions, less racially divided.
He'll explain why he thinks so on tomorrow's Morning Edition. This is NPR News.
It's 8:18. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Last summer, Tesla Motors chose a small town in Nevada to be the home of its massive new battery factory. We'll tell you about the race to build houses, businesses, and infrastructure at 8:45. Our weather forecast today, partly cloudy and cold, with afternoon highs in the teens and lower 20s.
Welcome in 2015 at the UW-Madison Arboretum's annual New Year's Eve Walk from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, December 31st. Free and open to the public, the walk begins at the Visitor Center on Arboretum Drive in Madison. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Still no sign of that Air Asia jet with 162 people aboard. It disappeared from radar over the weekend on a flight from Indonesia to Singapore. Indonesia's search chief says he believes the Airbus is at the bottom of the Java Sea. Oil spots have been seen on the water, but it's not clear if they're connected to the airliner. Deborah Hirschman is the former chair of the National Transportation Safety Board.
Investigators are going to be looking closely at that flight track, the last communications, and really trying to target that debris field and the recorders.
That's Hirschman speaking to CBS this morning. Later this week, the case of three Al Jazeera journalists held in Egypt goes to appeal. The three have been behind bars for a year, convicted on terror charges. NPR's Leila Fadel in Cairo says they're not the only journalists being held there.
There are other journalists in jail, bloggers, photographers, and also a lot of activists who've been jailed and convicted on what rights groups say are trumped-up charges. So even if these three do get released, it doesn't mean that the crackdown has ended on freedom of speech and on dissent in Egypt.
In the NFL, the San Francisco 49ers have parted ways with head coach Jim Harbaugh, and the New York Jets have fired coach Rex Ryan after the team missed the playoffs for the fourth straight season. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. Republicans in the Wisconsin Assembly will try for a second time to ban the poor from using food stamps to buy junk food. A similar bill passed the lower house in the last session, but never made it to the Senate floor. Now, Beaver Dam Republican Mark Bourne says he's willing to try again, even though the food service and grocery industries heavily lobbied against the measure last time. Also, Congress would need to change longtime rules in the USDA on the use of food stamps. Wisconsin's departing attorney general says he's confident crime labs are prepared to handle a dramatic increase in requests for DNA tests. Starting next April, police will have to submit a DNA sample from anyone arrested on a violent felony charge. Legislation was passed in the last session, which also requires the state to collect DNA from anyone convicted of a misdemeanor. Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen says lawmakers allowed the time needed to make sure those laboratories have the resources required. The Department of Justice estimates the state labs will have to test an additional 65,000 samples a year. Nearly 20 new staff members have been hired to process the new samples. The Green Bay Packers earned a first-round bye and a second seed in the NFL playoffs with their 30-20 win over the Lions yesterday. Also, Green Bay won its fourth straight NFC North Division championship. The week off should give Aaron Rodgers, the Packers quarterback, a chance to heal an injured left leg. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from A. Mark Foundation, supporting ProCon.org, a nonprofit educational website examining the pros and cons of controversial issues for students, teachers, and the public. Available online at ProCon.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. From Emily and Antoine Van Actmael, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. With the hack attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment, this has been an eventful few weeks in Hollywood. But as they say, the show must go on. And at this time of year, that means Oscars. Oscar voting begins today. And here to break things down for us is Kim Masters. She's editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Kim.
Hey, David.
So as usual, we have a bunch of films coming out late in the year with their movie makers hoping that they get Oscar nominations. Let's start with Best Picture. How is it shaping up, that race?
Well, it was very late to gel this year. I mean, usually by this time, there's this film that seems to have the mark of destiny or maybe two in contention. Mm-hmm. But it seems right now there's sort of a film that's considered an underdog frontrunner, and it opened back in July. And that film is Richard Linklater's film Boyhood. This is a film shot over 12 years with the same group of actors. And we'll take a little listen. This is Ethan Hawke playing the dad, Eller Coltrane playing the son. And like a lot of dads, it's a pretty relatable movie. He's trying to get his children to talk to him about what goes on in their lives.
Talk to me. Mason, how was your week?
Well, Dad, you know, it was kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them, but I said no, because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
But, Dad, I mean, why is it all on us, though? You know, what about you? How was your week? You know, who do you hang out with? Do you have a girlfriend? What have you been up to?
I see your point.
Okay, so that's Boyhood. What other films might be standing in its way?
Well, there's Birdman, starring Michael Keaton as a washed-up actor who played a superhero, which, in fact, you might recall Michael Keaton actually did, Batman.
Batman.
And he's trying to redeem himself. We also have Imitation Game, which is a story of Alan Turing, you know, who cracked the Enigma code during World War II. A Theory of Everything, the story of Stephen Hawking. And coming in late is Selma, which is, of course, a story of Martin Luther King and the passage of the Voting Rights Act and that historic march that was organized to pressure the White House to move on this very important issue.
Okay, so a lot of films up potentially for Best Picture. Let's hear a little bit of Michael Keaton from the movie Birdman, and then I want to ask you a question about it.
About me?
Look, I'm trying to do something that's important.
This is not important.
It's important to me. Okay? Maybe not to you or your cynical friends whose only ambition is to go viral, but to me, this is, my God, this is my career.
Okay, so that's Michael Keaton. He is among those being considered for Best Actor. Who else is in that mix?
A pretty packed category, of course. Benedict Cumberbatch for Imitation Game, Eddie Redmayne for The Theory of Everything. David Oyelowo, he is playing Dr. Martin Luther King in Selma.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed.
That sounds like powerful stuff. Let's move to Best Actress. It sounds like a less packed category than Best Actor, and a lot of the attention seems to be focusing right now on Julianne Moore, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It is kind of a thin category this year, very unfortunately. Julianne Moore has been nominated several times, but she is coming on strong in a film that I think very few people have heard of at this point. It's called Still Alice. It's this poignant story of a professor who gets early Alzheimer's. Meanwhile, I think Reese Witherspoon had hoped to storm the category. She optioned the bestseller Wild and, you know, threw her heart and soul into it, and I think had hoped that this would be her year. But those are the two performances that people are talking about.
And Kim, one last thing in the directing category. We might actually have a first this year.
We have Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma. And Ava DuVernay is kind of a remarkable character. I mean, she was a publicist in Hollywood for 14 years. She's already done some firsts as an African-American woman director, and that has to be a very appealing choice to the Academy with this historically significant film. It's the kind of thing that they go for. She would be the first African-American woman to win in that category, and it's a chance for the Academy to make history.
All right. Well, the voting for Oscars starts today. We've been hearing a bit of a preview from Kim Masters. Kim, thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.
She hosts The Business on member station KCRW.
And now let's go overseas. Here is one more reason for Ireland's economic growth. It's a giant mine beneath the rolling countryside. It's the largest zinc mine in Europe. That's big business. NPR's Ari Shapiro went down to have a look.
Manufacturing jobs come and go. Factories can move overseas. But a mine stays put. The Tara Zinc Mine opened here outside of Dublin in 1977. It now has third-generation employees and people like Paddy White, who's worked here for 35 years.
So I was 19 when I started here.
Was there ever a time when you found it difficult not to see the sun during the day?
No, but if I'm out of here for any length of time, I get nervous. I see a lot of the sun now, I get nervous.
Zinc runs in his blood. Well, technically, the mineral runs in every human's blood, but especially his. He even tracks the global commodities markets.
How's it doing nowadays?
Very good. Yeah. Very good. 126 today.
You know exactly the price of zinc today?
Yeah, I do, because that's all, when it's all you have, you know it.
Welcome to Tara Mines. The following DVD is our guidelines for visitors underground.
Mine disasters get a lot of attention around the world, but when you're half a mile underground, much less dramatic incidents can be huge problems, so safety is crucial. Just think, if someone in a factory has a heart attack, they can be at a hospital in minutes. Where we're going, it takes half an hour driving underground just to get to the workplace. Down here, there is no weather. There are no weeds growing in the cracks. There is no color but gray. The left and right turns all look the same. Workers give these tunnels tongue-in-cheek street names. JFK, the Chairman Trench.
Tesco, Bondi Beach.
The Abyss.
More than 600 people work in this mine. It is so big that we hardly see any of them on our drive through the tunnels. Finally, we arrive at what they call the crusher, half a mile below the surface.
This is this sort of massive underground cavern with lights shining down into the center of it. And we're on a little mesh walkway standing over the largest of five crushers, where huge, huge boulders of ore are just being crushed up into almost like gravel-sized chunks. Then they'll be carried back up to the surface.
The crusher is run from a laptop. We return to the surface exactly the same, plus a thin layer of dust. Even after just an hour underground, the sunlight is blinding. Our guide says that shocking sight of sky is what every miner looks for. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Journalist James Fallow says we revere and honor the military, but we don't take it seriously. He says if we did, we'd be more critical, like earlier generations.
Dwight Eisenhower was tough on generals. Harry Truman was tough on generals. Abraham Lincoln was famously tough on generals.
Fallow's on the tragedy of the U.S. military. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 3, see our complete schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Pennsylvania was once the national capital of nails. A census report in 1810 said Pennsylvanians made 9 pounds of nails for each person in the state. This New Year's Eve, a 200-year-old Pennsylvania town is celebrating. Never mind the ball drop in Times Square, West Fairview will drop a 7-foot-tall nail. The Sentinel reports other towns celebrate by dropping a button, a pickle, and a giant pair of yellow pants. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31, and we're glad you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. For many Americans, 2014 was the year the heroin epidemic hit home.
In the past year, awareness has really taken off, in large part because of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death.
Right after this break, more on the growing number of fatal heroin overdoses and what's being done to save lives.
When you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, you're enjoying the results of membership support. 50,000 members help make this unique radio service possible. You can learn more about WPR and all of our programs by visiting WPR.org. Wisconsin Public Radio brings you inspiring music every day, from great recordings to live studio performances. You'll find old favorites and new discoveries each time you tune in. Join us on the air or listen online at WPR.org.
Do these comments sound familiar? I feel connected and well-informed. WPR makes me think more critically and laugh more often. Sometimes while listening to WPR, I can't get out of my car till the story is done. If Wisconsin Public Radio is a vital part of your life, make a special gift by becoming a member of the 9XM Leadership Circle with a gift of $100 a month or more. Visit WPR.org/support. Thanks.
The weather in Wisconsin today, partly cloudy skies and cold temperatures with highs this afternoon in the teens and lower 20s. Clear and very cold tonight with lows around 0 to 10 below. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs in the single digits and lower teens. A bit of a warm-up, if you want to call it that, at the end of this week. Right now, Superior, 2 below, Madison, 19 above. In Green Bay, it's 16 degrees.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art. Presenting the exhibition Henri Matisse, The Cutouts, now through February 10th. Information about tickets, as well as late weekend and holiday hours, is at moma.org/Matisse. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
On the last Monday of the year, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Today in your health, we're learning more about a drug that does not seem to discriminate when it claims victims, heroin. People of all different races and ethnicities use the drug. There are users in poor urban neighborhoods. There are victims among the wealthy and the elite. The death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman in February drew fresh attention to heroin in 2014. It was a year that can best be called mixed. Number of fatal overdoses continue to climb, but as we're about to hear, people have been working hard on new ways to save lives. Here's NPR's Laura Starczewski.
Priscilla Graham Farmer was going to get her hair done. This was in September in Newark, New Jersey. The elevator in the building she went into was broken, so Priscilla took the stairs. And that's when she saw him, a young guy, sprawled out, not moving.
He was literally turning blue. Lips was grayish blue, and everybody was walking over him.
But Priscilla stopped and looked closer.
He had the needle, the whole little kit, cotton balls. He had everything right there on the staircase.
The guy had clearly overdosed.
And I'm screaming in the hallway. Nobody's answering. And I said, okay, dial 911.
Priscilla lives in New Jersey, but she's a caseworker at a drug treatment center in New York City. And in her car, she had a silver bullet, a naloxone kit, or Narcan, as most people call it. It's an overdose reversal drug. Priscilla carries her kit wherever she goes.
I ran back to the car, got the kit. I was parked right in front of the building.
She had a nasal spray version of Narcan. You just pop a vial of clear liquid into an atomizer and squeeze half a dose up one nostril, half up the other, which is what Priscilla did.
He woke up, and all I could do is hold him and hug him because he was 21, but looked like he was 15, and he cried.
Priscilla knew what to do because the whole staff at the drug treatment center where she works, Samaritan Village in Richmond Hill, Queens, has been trained to use Narcan. The clients, the people who are there trying to stay clean, are trained too. So if they're with someone who overdoses, they can help. But Priscilla's boss, Jim Hollywood, says that Samaritan Village was ahead of the curve on that one, because for many people who work in drug treatment, preparing addicts for the very real possibility of relapse goes against a focus on sobriety.
People are concerned that if you give somebody who has an opiate addiction Narcan kit, you're basically saying you can get high.
But Hollywood says that given the rising numbers of overdose deaths and the fact that just under half his clients complete the program at Samaritan Village, they had to face reality.
You can't help an addict get recovery if they're dead.
That logic has been slow to spread in drug treatment programs. But that's changing, says Ann Siegler, an overdose researcher at New York City's Department of Health.
In the past year, I would say, awareness has really taken off, in large part because of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death.
Siegler says that awareness is part of a bigger shift in terms of who is dying of overdoses. The issue's getting more attention because it's not just affecting people living in poor urban neighborhoods.
The rates are rising in white and middle-class communities, and so the conversation has really changed.
Now the health department is just trying to keep up with the demand. They're on track to distribute around 30,000 doses of Narcan citywide this year, twice as many as last year.
We get programs calling us and emailing us saying, we heard about this in the news, or we saw it in the paper. My friend was talking about naloxone. How can I get it? How can I get my program distributing it? Where can I go to a training?
Those trainings are now reaching police. Thousands more across New York State started carrying Narcan this year, EMTs, and also regular people who have family or friends they know are using.
So first off, the medication you guys are all going to get tonight, it's called naloxone, or the brand name is Narcan.
At the Lindenhurst Public Library out in Suffolk County on Long Island, Tina Wolf is leading a free community training on preventing overdose. Not just heroin, but prescription opioids too.
So we're talking about morphine, we're talking about fentanyl, methadone, Suboxone.
Suffolk is the young, white, suburban face of this epidemic. More than 200 people died of an overdose in Suffolk County last year, some of them teenagers. There are a few dozen worried-looking parents and neighbors in this room. The deaths have hit home for many of them, like Joan Taroni, Anthony Avella, and Terry Kroll.
I lost a cousin to a heroin overdose. He was 25.
I did lose a friend that I went to high school with.
I lost my son to a drug overdose in 2009.
Giving all these people Narcan rescue kits would have been tough before this year. Narcan's always been in a fuzzy legal zone because it's a prescription drug, but you don't take it yourself, and you don't know ahead of time who you might need to give it to. This summer, a new law in New York made it much easier to get Narcan into the hands of regular people, keeping trainers like Tina Wolf busy.
This is my car that I basically work from.
When she's not doing big group trainings, Wolf makes house calls in her car. Discreet, mobile, perfect for the suburbs, where people don't want their neighbors to know that they or someone in their family is using. Wolf's trunk is packed with clean syringes and sterile injection supplies. More younger users out here are shooting heroin, cheaper and more available than pain pills. Wolf says they don't always know how to keep themselves safe.
And I ask them, you know, if they've shared needles with people or that sort of thing. It's like, well, yeah, but only, you know, a couple people. And, you know, we talk about HIV transmission, and they're like, oh, you can still get that?
Wolf also hires people who use to help her. She brings them thousands of clean syringes to hand out to their social network. We went to see her employee, Rich, who started using back in the 1970s. He's used his Narcan rescue kit about 5 times so far.
You know, it's a good feeling to know that you saved somebody. Sometimes I wish I could tell their parents, hey, you know what I just had to do for your kid? you know, but it's not my business.
Rich says kids are afraid to tell their parents, afraid to call the cops. They're even afraid to go to the hospital after they get revived, because even though people are more willing to acknowledge the overdose epidemic in Suffolk County, how to help people who are still using, what to do with the kids who do wake up, is a more difficult problem to solve. Laura Starczewski, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:41. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. Good morning. Coming up in 10 minutes on the Marketplace Morning Report, we'll look at interest rates, wages, and the global economy in 2015. Our weather for today, partly cloudy and cold, with afternoon highs in the teens and lower 20s.
Journalist James Fallow says we revere and honor the military, but we don't take it seriously. He says if we did, we'd be more critical, like earlier generations.
Dwight Eisenhower was tough on generals. Harry Truman was tough on generals. Abraham Lincoln was famously tough on generals.
Fallow's on the tragedy of the U.S. military. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon at 3.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The CEO of AirAsia says he's not commenting on speculation as to what happened to AirAsia Flight 8501.
We don't really want to speculate until we find the aircraft. We know what went wrong, then we'll look into it and see, you know, what we need to improve, if we need to improve. But it's speculation at the moment, so it's premature to talk at the moment.
That's CEO Tony Fernandez at a news conference in Jakarta. The airliner disappeared over the weekend on a flight from Indonesia to Singapore. There were 162 people aboard. Oil spots have been seen in the Java Sea, but so far nothing's been connected to the flight. 2014 is going down as a strong sales year for the nation's auto industry. But NPR's Sonari Glinton reports it's also been a year for safety recalls, including millions of vehicles with potentially defective airbags.
There have been more than 60 million cars recalled for safety-related defects so far this year. That's more than twice the previous record. And part of what's going on is the auto industry is becoming more simple at the same time as becoming more complex, meaning there are fewer and fewer parts suppliers that are supplying the entire globe. So one bad part can end up affecting not just one car company, but the entire industry.
A suicide bomber is blamed for killing at least 15 people today in Iraq. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell. For the third time in 7 months, a young child has been killed by gunfire in Milwaukee. 13-month-old Bill Thau died Saturday night at a relative's home where somebody shot bullets from outside. Police say more than one gun was involved as dozens of shots were fired into the home. Mayor Tom Barrett told reporters yesterday that people in the house apparently had nothing to do with the suspects who were shooting. Police say they have one promising lead but did not have anything to do with the family or the home that was hit. Last May, 10-year-old Sierra Guyton was shot and killed in crossfire on a school playground. Last month, 5-year-old Layla Peterson was shot to death by bullets fired into her grandparents' house. The Reverend Jesse Jackson says he'll continue to draw attention to the case of a Milwaukee man who was killed by a police officer last April. Jackson was speaking before a crowd of 200 people during a rally at his Rainbow Push Coalition headquarters in Chicago Saturday. Relatives and supporters of Dontre Hamilton were there. Hamilton was shot and killed by former Milwaukee police officer Christopher Manny in a downtown park.
Although the local prosecutor will not charge him, the U.S. Attorney's Office says a federal investigation will be conducted. The actor who played Screech in the 1990s TV show Saved by the Bell is expected to appear in a courtroom in Port Washington this afternoon. Dustin Diamond is accused of stabbing a man during a bar fight on Christmas in Port Washington. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Terry Bell.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, combining conventional and integrative therapies to help maintain quality of life during treatment at cancercenter.com. From the Joyce Foundation, working to encourage businesses and consumers to save money and electricity through energy efficiency, joycefdn.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Small communities in Nevada face an economic test. It's how to gain from an opportunity. This past summer, the electric car maker Tesla Motors chose Nevada to become the home of its massive battery factory. It was a bounty for Nevada towns that have seen years of slow economic recovery. Here's Will Stone of Reno Public Radio.
When Lance Gilman talks Tesla, it can feel like a return to the days of the gold rush, silver mining, and pioneers.
The new Comstock load is sitting right in front of us right now. There's going to be tremendous financial growth.
The Comstock was the lucrative silver deposit discovered here in the 1800s. Gilman believes Tesla's $5 billion battery factory holds the same promise.
And they've chosen to locate here in Storey County in the Tahoe-Reno Industrial Center. And that choice then triggered a tsunami wave of follow-up business.
Gilman runs this industrial park where the factory is being built, about 30 minutes outside Reno. At the top of a plateau, he points to a scene of cranes and equipment below.
You can see that there's construction going on down there. They're putting footings in right now.
In a few years, the so-called Gigafactory will churn out more lithium-ion batteries than all the producers in the world combined. And Gilman says Nevada was the unlikely winner in a bidding war with states like California and Texas.
Everybody was throwing huge amounts of financial support and commitments, et cetera, et cetera. Here's this little old Storey County with 3,800 people in it. And to come out the winner, I think that's epic.
So, too, the gains. The factory will employ about 6,500 workers alone. Add in the indirect jobs, and that's more than five times the population of this small rural county. The local construction unions say they'll have to nearly triple their numbers in the next 5 years to meet demand. And that's not the only industry playing catch-up.
This is the machine shop, and manufacturing has slowly been emerging in the northern Nevada market.
Jim New is dean of technical sciences at Truckee Meadows Community College. He says Tesla has brought a new cachet to this field.
And when we started talking to prospective students about options that were out there, suddenly, they were very interested in these types of programs, especially those tied to advanced manufacturing.
New says their graduates won't necessarily be working in Tesla's factory, but they will make parts for the assembly line, for example. Bernie Magnus actually worked in construction during the housing boom. After years of unemployment, he's now a student in this manufacturing program.
There was so much growth residentially and commercially going on that there wasn't enough carpenters to go around. And right now, it's kind of like the same way. There's not enough machine operators to go around for the work.
The governor's office estimates a statewide economic impact of $100 billion over the next two decades. But Tesla didn't come cheap. The company received a package of incentives and tax abatements totaling more than $1 billion. Tesla isn't going to pay property, payroll, or sales tax for years.
Who is going to pay for the services that the workers are going to use? Who's going to pay for the firefighters, the police, the schools?
Bob Fulkerson is with the advocacy group, the Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada.
We always have this mentality about, well, we'll just figure that out down the road. You know, maybe there'll be gold in the next gold rush. You know, it's this boom and bust mentality.
But Tesla's abatements are performance-based, and the increase in people working and living here will supply new revenue, says developer Lance Gilman.
I'm going to suggest we just all get busy and earn our money. It's here. We only have it to lose.
And unlike the Comstock load, Nevada hopes Tesla will bring lasting prosperity. For NPR News, I'm Will Stone in Reno.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Hey, you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Terry Bell. It's about 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Morning Classics begins at 9 o'clock. Today's highlights include a piano sonata by Mozart and a set of bagatelles by Finzi. Join Ruth Ann Bestman right after the Marketplace Morning Report.
The Janesville Performing Arts Center presents Postnuptial Agreement, on stage January 9th through the 11th, as part of their local talent month. Directed by Naomi Hauser, the play tells the story of a terminally ill man who's planning his family's future without him. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support local theater productions. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
It'll be cold today, partly cloudy skies and afternoon highs in the teens and lower 20s. Clear skies tonight and overnight lows from around 0 to 10 below. It'll be very cold tomorrow with highs in the single digits and teens, the same for Wednesday. Later in the week, though, a slight chance of snow and slightly milder temperatures with highs in the teens and low 20s on Thursday and Friday.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Von Briesen and Roper, Central Wisconsin Symphony Orchestra, and Mineral Point Artisans. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. When you shop with our online partners like the NPR Shop or Amazon.com, a portion of your purchase may benefit Wisconsin Public Radio. Learn more at WPR.org/shop.
During this intra-holiday week, the lights are on at the stock markets, but is anyone home?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio, checking markets, business, and jobs as Wall Street trading begins. Amid some uncertainty in Europe after Greece was forced to schedule an unexpected general election, let's check the numbers. 21 minutes into trading, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 11 points, not quite a tenth percent. The S&P 500 is flat. It's down by about half a point. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up by 2 points. Greece's main stock index is off its lows of the day with that election on the way, but it's still down more than 4% at the moment. The DAX in Germany is down 0.8%. On this Monday, let's consult Quincy Crosby, market strategist at Prudential Financial. Good morning.
Good morning.
So these days between Christmas and New Year's, you know, we think it's computers driving everything on the markets, but there are still humans who take vacation. You think that'll play out with trading volumes today?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We know that the volume is down. I mean, volume was down last week. It's probably going to be down this week. And with low volume, David, you can have the market skewed in either direction. Historically, in terms of what we call seasonality, that skew has usually been very positive this time of year because low volume, good feeling in the market, money coming in, you know, managers trying to get that last bit of performance. It tends to be a good time for the market, but if something negative hits, it could skew it the other way.
Well, there is some concern, for instance, today, suddenly Greece has a new election. It's possibly on the 25th of January. That's causing jitters because polls suggest a party will come to power who might want to renegotiate the debt.
Exactly. That is putting jitters in the market. But, you know, the one thing about the market, which is really kind of fascinating, is it gets bored with certain subjects. You know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, this could have just put everyone in a horrible mood, had the markets go into a deep dive. Yeah, it's bothering the markets right now. But perhaps by the end of the day, you know, the market will say, you know what, they'll get over this. We'll get over this.
Quincy Crosby, the market strategist at Prudential Financial. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you, David. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Walgreens, the biggest drugstore chain in the U.S., is poised to become the biggest drugstore chain on the planet. At a company meeting about to start in New York now, shareholder votes will be tallied as the Walgreen company tries to complete its $21 billion merger with U.K.-based drugstore chain Alliance Boots. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Alliance Boots has 4,500 stores across Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. Walgreens has more than 8,000 here in the U.S. But with weaker discount programs and worse-performing stores, Walgreens has lost ground to rivals, according to retail consultant Bert Flickinger. He says this merger
Warehouse, Walgreens, Alliance, Boots to pole vault past CVS or anyone else in global competition.
As the company expands overseas, analysts expect fewer stores to be opened in the U.S. Meanwhile, Walgreens could benefit from some of Boots' higher-end European offerings, says John Pizzilla, a former Walgreens executive who still owns shares in the company.
Some of Boots' private label is very high quality. Here, when you see private label, you typically think, well, this is second tier.
Selling more premium store brands could help Walgreens, since it's the front of the store items, groceries, health and beauty products, that increasingly drive drugstore profits. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Ticker symbol WAG, Walgreens stock is down 0.2% at 76.23, quite close to its high of the year.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Battelle. Battelle's NeuroBridge technology is helping a paralyzed man to move again. Learn more at Battelle.org.
Toward the end of 2013, when people asked the Wall Street Brain Trust about the year ahead, just about everyone said, well, interest rates will definitely rise and bonds will definitely go down. It's not quite what transpired, and money was lost. With that caveat in mind, we're talking to our roster of Marketplace reporters about the road ahead, from the business of education, sustainability, to healthcare. Last week, we talked about trade policy in 2015. Today, one of the Marketplace New York reporters, Sabri Benishour, talked to him about 2015 markets. Hello there, Sabri.
Hi, David.
So care to venture what stories you're going to get stuck with in 2015?
You know, as far as Wall Street goes, I know already it is all about the Federal Reserve. We think it will raise rates in mid-2015. What the Fed does with interest rates will tell us how currencies move. It will tell us how emerging markets go, where yields go. And as we get closer and closer to that point, we're going to be scrutinizing every move that the economy makes because we're at this tipping point where things are going to change.
And we have no choice but to cover this because market participants are watching this very carefully. I mean, if they do raise rates, it's the first time, right, since the Great Recession.
And we are in a different world. You know, it's not like raising rates before the recession. The Fed has different tools to influence banks. It has different powers altogether. It's like driving a brand new car, you know. How is it going to work in a world where our economy starts heating up, if that is the world that we see in 2015?
All right. So interest rates do define a lot of our financial lives. But, you know, in 2015, what about what we're getting paid?
There's this question in the Consumer Confidence Survey that asks people, how much do you think your income will go up this year? And, you know, in 2008, it hit zero and has pretty much stayed there since until 2 or 3 months ago when it moved up around 2%. So maybe that's a sign that wages will actually start to go up.
But a lot of things to keep a very close eye on in 2015 as well, things that might unravel.
There's a lot of things in the U.S. that seem to be going very, very well, but there's also the rest of the world. Europe is not doing so hot. How will it do? Growth in China is slowing. Emerging markets have been taking a hit for a while. Our currency is getting a lot stronger. Are we going to head towards deflation because between gas prices and all these goods from elsewhere in the world declining in value, our price is going to get too cheap for us? And that, of course, gets us back to the Fed. If prices are moving down, but our growth is moving up, well, it's anyone's guess how they'll react.
All right. Marketplace's New York reporter, Sabri Benishour, thank you.
Thanks, David.
The Financial Times today was reviewing words of the year, such as vape to smoke electronic cigarettes. And if we hear the word selfie one more time. But what about nomophobia? The etymology isn't clear till you think about it. Phobia of no mobile. Nomophobia, the fear of losing your phone. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you heard it on Wisconsin Public Radio, where there's more news for you throughout the day, with headlines from NPR and WPR at noon, All Things Considered from 3 to 6:30 this afternoon, and stories to listen to, read, and comment on anytime at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from Sustainable Engineering Group, dedicated to reducing energy usage in building systems, specializing in commissioning of net zero energy buildings, geothermal design, and energy studies, on the web at sustainenergy.com.
Support also comes from Shelley Moffat of Edward Jones in Wanakee, providing investments and information to help individuals achieve their retirement goals. Edward Jones, making sense of investing. Member SIPC, 849-6649.
You're listening to WGTD HD.